tired. This was his comeuppance, of course. He'd spent the last 6 months ignoring Agatha while she was with him, and now that she was gone, all he could think about was when she'd be back. He quickened his pace towards the basement, vowing to lift extra heavy today. He always felt better about himself after a punishing workout. Except now he was obsessing over why he hadn't received any letters from her. It took a day or two at most for a courier crow to deliver a note, and Agatha had taken the new crow that Camelot had finally saved enough to buy. So why hadn't she written? Magic was no use in finding her either. He'd been crap at spells at school, preferring to win battles with a sword, so he'd plundered Merlin's chamber, searching for a crystal ball or something that might help him pinpoint Agatha in the woods. No luck. He'd even cast a locating spell out of the only one of Merlin's spellbooks he could actually read. But the first time he tried it, he'd summoned a bowl of grapefruits from the kitchen, and the second time, he'd made all of Agatha's undergarments float around the castle for hours before guards had to shoot them down with bows and arrows. Tedros stopped outside the gymnasium in full panic. Where was she? Was she safe? Was she even alive? He pressed his forehead to the wall and struggled to breathe. First, his mother and Lance sent off. Now his princess too. Even Merlin had disappeared again, though according to the royal rot there'd been a sighting of him near the school for good by an Inga troll, who insisted Merlin was having secret trysts with Professor Dovey in her office. Tedros was so desperate for news of Agatha he'd succumbed to reading trash, only to stop when he saw the rot had started labelling him the so-called king. He'd felt so alone after the coronation. But now he had no one he trusted in this castle anymore. Now he was truly alone. Even worse, as he scoured the newspapers, Tedros saw it wasn't just Camelot or his friends' quests that were in trouble. All the kingdoms in the woods were plagued by mysterious attacks, just as the letters he'd received from the leaders of these realms had attested. The selfish part of him was comforted that other leaders were having just as hard a time as he was. But these kings and queens, from both Ever and Neverlands, were calling upon Camelot, on him, to take the lead in building a woods-wide coalition and rooting out those responsible for the violence. It's what Tedros' father had done when wars between good and evil had raged out of control, threatening the woods. And it's ultimately what killed him. Sapped and impaired by his drunken spells, Arthur had still ridden into battle at the Fourpoint to forge peace between warring sides, and paid for it with his life. Despite Tedros pleading with his father not to go, despite Tedros begging him to stay home as the king put on his armor. Perhaps this was one of the reasons why Tedros now ignored these calls for help from other kingdoms and refused meetings with any of its leaders. But the new king also had no help to offer them. Camelot had no money, no knights, Chadwick was still missing, and no army. Plus, Camelot had yet to be attacked like the rest of the kingdoms, and its people didn't seem to care about what was happening in realms beyond its own. Camelot could no longer be the woods policemen. They were too busy with their own problems, like growing poverty and a bankrupt treasury and rising crime. And a so-called king. Tedros's eyes opened. Looking past the wall, he could see Excalibur's empty case, lit up by gem-blue moonlight. That sword. Everything was going wrong because of that sword. Tedros never made it to King's Cove. He'd turned back and gone straight to the Blue Tower balcony, dismissed a listless guard, and launched himself at Excalibur once more with no other strategy than beating out his own fury. Until he wrenched the hilt so brutally, he split open a blister on his left hand. Now blood was spurting off his palm, trailing him everywhere like a shadow. He hustled through the Blue Tower, past the famous map room where the Round Table had once met, but now lay cobwebbed and dormant. He could hear worried stewards calling to each other, having seen his blood. He didn't want to talk to them. He didn't care if they thought he was wounded or dead. He wanted it to be like school, where he could lock himself in a dorm room or bathroom to be alone, and if he missed class, he'd be punished with detention or kitchen duties, neither with any real consequence. His father had been like this after his mother left. Arthur would slip off without a word and shut himself in the White Tower guest room, to which the king had the only key. It was where Tedros was headed now. Merlin was right. Maybe I'm more like Dad than I thought. Tedros thought mordantly. He could hear his stewards filing into the White Tower, but he was already upstairs, gliding in his socks towards the door at the end of the hall. He pulled out his cramped keyring, finding the gold-toothed key next to a small black one, slipped it in the lock, and swung into the room, latching the door behind him. The room was dark. He slid down and plopped on the warm marble, feet splayed in front of him. Blood leaked from his hand onto the skin of his thigh. He stripped off his shirt and wrapped it around his palm like a tourniquet, but that only seemed to make it bleed more. Out of ideas, he thrust his hand in the pocket of his gym shorts and leaned against the door. The room smelled like musk and earth and sweat. His father had it built as a private guest suite that he could invite his most personal friends to stay in, but Arthur had never used it for guests, as far as Tedros knew. His father didn't even allow maids in this room when he was alive, let alone his wife or his son, though Tedros had broken in once as a child, having picked the lock during a game of hide-and-seek with the fairies. When the king found out, it was the one and only time his dad had given him a thrashing. It's why Tedros hadn't come back to this place before today. It reminded him of his father's disappointment in him. Using his good hand, Tedros lit his finger glow like a torch, suffusing the room with soft gold. It still looked the same as it had then. A patterned brown and orange rug, a sunken leather sofa, and a modest bed in the corner. It didn't seem royal at all, let alone fitting for a guest suite. Felt more like something you'd find at a seedy Netherwood inn, Tedros thought, scanning the bare beige walls with his glow. Why had his father built a private room so common and far away from the better parts of the castle? A guest room that guests never used? Two green eyes speared through the torchlight. Tedros lurched back, bashing his head against the door. Reaper moseyed out of the shadows, batting at fleas. "Oh, it's you," Tedros grumped, rubbing his skull. He felt woozy, though he didn't know whether it was because of the head bump or his hand, which was still spewing a profuse amount of blood. "How'd you even get in here?" Before Agatha left, he'd told her to take her unholy cat with her, but she'd brushed him off. "Someone has to watch over you," she'd quipped. He'd assumed it was a joke. This was the cat that had bitten him, spat at him, peed in his shoes, and once carved heathen symbols into his bathroom mirror. But now that Agatha was gone, the heinous little imp had been following Tedros everywhere he went, and even sleeping outside his chambers. Reaper prowled closer and poked at Tedros's injured hand with his paw, nudging it out of his pocket. Grunting ominously, the cat sniffed the blood-soaked bandage. Then he climbed on Tedros's thigh and slashed the cloth open with his claw. "Hey," Tedros said. But now Reaper seized Tedros's hand in his mouth, tongue to his skin, teeth starting to sink in. Tedros kicked him hard, sending the cat flying into the wall. "You little cretin," he gasped. Reaper hobbled away, whimpering, and slunk under the bed in the corner. Shaken, Tedros studied his hand to see the damage. "Huh?" He lit it up with his glow. His hand wasn't bleeding anymore, and the wound looked smaller. Slowly, he lifted his head and saw Reaper's dim, wet pupils under the bed frame.
"You were trying to help me, weren't you?"
Tedros asked.
"That's why you've been following me all week. You're watching over me, just like Agatha said."
Reaper hissed weakly and receded into darkness. Tedros lay on his bare stomach at the foot of the bed and peeked underneath.
"I'm sorry, little fella. I'm the cretin, not you. I can't do anything these days without hurting someone, not even a cat."
He rolled onto his back.
"I can't do this anymore. I can't be a half-king. My people don't deserve a half-king. But how can there be order and progress when I can't prove I'm fully king?"
He roared in frustration and slung his keys at the ceiling, cracking the plaster.
"I'm Arthur's son. It doesn't matter what Agatha finds in the woods. It doesn't matter what's happening to my classmates. This is Camelot. The crown is mine. It's always been mine. So why won't that cursed sword move?"
"I never did think that girl was the homesick type," a voice said.
Tedros sprung up to see Lady Gremlane's shadow in the open doorway.
"But then again, I never took you for a liar," she said, glaring at him.
"I came here to be alone," he retorted, eyeing his keys on the floor. "I thought the king had the only key."
"He does," Lady Gremlane replied. "Only he forgot to lock the door."
Tedros stared at her.
"But I did lock it."
"Shall we walk?"
his steward said, holding open the door.
"The treasury master wants to see you. You're hardly dressed and bleeding, and to be honest, I'm not particularly fond of this room."
"I don't make it a habit of lying, but where Agatha went is between me, her, and Merlin," Tedros asserted.
"So, you met Merlin too?"
frowned Lady Gremlane, clacking ahead into a big, circular white hall.
"I told you, I don't care who my father banished."
"Your caring is irrelevant. Until your coronation is sealed, you cannot withdraw your father's decrees. Not Merlin's banishment, not the bounty on your mother's head."
"Look, there are things happening you wouldn't understand," said Tedros, shirtless and shoeless as he chased her lavender silhouette. "You're my steward and here to help me with whatever I ask. Anything outside of that is my domain."
"I see," Lady Gremlane said, facing him. "So what you're telling me is even though I was your father's right hand, even though you've asked me to supervise your every decision, and even though I'm the only reason this kingdom is in one piece, you still don't trust me.
Tedros couldn't meet her eyes. They were standing on a floor of cracked mosaic that depicted the Camelot seal. Given his crap morning, Tedros found it fitting he was straddling Excalibur's blade. The circular walls were covered in dozens of framed paintings, reminding him of the Legends obelisk at the School for Good, decorated with portraits of famous alumni. He'd been in this hall only a few times as a child, since the White Tower was far away from the others and used mostly for knights' meetings, arms-making and staff quarters. Tedros had never paid much attention to the walls back then. But now, one of the paintings caught his attention, since unlike the others, it had no other paintings near it. He stepped towards it, eyes wide.
"It's me."
He was wearing his father's coronation robes, though most of the portrait was a close-up of his face. His hair was angelic blonde, his eyes unnaturally blue, his skin as pure as gold dust. Everything about the Tedros in the painting seemed more Tedros than the real him, including his piercing, omniscient gaze. This Tedros was strong, mature, unflappable. This Tedros looked like a king.
"Who drew it? I didn't sit for a royal portrait."
"That's because it was painted 16 years ago," Lady Gremlane answered, cinching her turban. "Your father commissioned it from a seer after you were born. In his will, he said it was to be put up on your coronation day in the Hall of Kings."
Looking around, Tedros noticed the art was arranged in chronological columns, with each king's coronation portrait surrounded by smaller paintings of triumphant moments.
"One day your wall will be complete too," said Lady Gremlane.
Tedros honed in on his father's column. While Tedros's coronation painting was beautiful and inspiring, Arthur's portrayed him as a scrawny, timorous, red-faced teenager who didn't look capable of brushing his own teeth, let alone running Camelot.
"This is Dat," Tedros said.
"Painted by the palace artist on the morning of his coronation, per tradition,"
Lady Gremlane confirmed.
"Given the result, your father fired the artist. And to ensure your coronation painting would be to his liking, he solicited the seer to imagine yours upon your birth. A portrait that would capture the essence of your soul and future."
"But if Dad hated his so much, why would he leave it up?"
"Oh, he made us take it down again and again. But in time it would always mysteriously return, most likely by his own hand. It became quite clear that though your father loathed the painting, he also couldn't part with it. Perhaps it reminded him of the real Arthur, before his time at the School for Good and Evil changed him."
Tedros looked at her, puzzled.
"He was crowned before he went to school. But he wouldn't have been old enough..."
"How little you know of your father," his steward said drolly. "Back then, Camelot was so in need of a leader that they crowned Arthur even though he wasn't yet 16, which meant he attended school as a legitimate king and an instant celebrity. No doubt you endured this yourself as a famous prince, with girls desperate to be your queen."
"You have no idea," Tedros murmured, thinking of Sophie.
"The difference is that you spent your whole life knowing you would be king, while Arthur was an ordinary boy who accidentally found himself the most powerful ruler in the woods. One morning he'd gone out, feverishly seeking a new sword for his master, Arthur had been punished for losing the old one, and he stumbled upon Excalibur, trapped in an anvil in the village square. He pulled the sword easily without a second thought, intending to return it to the stone at a later date. What he didn't know was that Excalibur had been placed in that stone by the Lady of the Lake to settle the question of who would rule Camelot after a violent period of chaos and anarchy. Thousands had come from all over the woods to try their hand at the sword before Arthur freed it from the stone without any knowledge of the consequences. So when he sat for this portrait, he was still very much a scared young boy, but also sensitive and whip-smart. It's why Merlin took so strongly to him, as did I. Perhaps it's the only area where the wizard and I ever agreed.
Tedros looked back at his father's face, so lost and overwhelmed. And for a moment, it felt like Tedros was looking at his own. Unnerved, he shifted to another painting. This one of his mother and Arthur playing with their baby son, while a young, dark-haired female stood in the shadows. His father was holding the baby up in the air as his mother tickled the boy's stomach. Tedros found himself smiling before he remembered everything that happened between his parents once that baby grew up.
"Did your father really never mention my name to you?"
Lady Gremlane asked.
"Not even once."
Lady Gremlane took this in with a wry grin.
"Like father, like son."
Tedros furrowed, not understanding.
"When Agatha was pressing to see you, I pointed out that you too never mentioned her name to me. Not even once," said Lady Gremlane. "Taking the women in your life for granted seems a shared trait."
"Well, Agatha and I are very different from you and my father, obviously."
Tedros snorted.
"How long did you even know him?"
His steward paused before answering.
"Arthur and I grew up together. I'm not so much older than he was. We met because I was a housemaid to Sir Ector, Arthur's master, when Arthur was brought from the orphanage. Arthur and I soon became friends, for we were both treated quite poorly as children. So when he was crowned and needed a steward, he brought me to Camelot, even though I was hardly capable of managing a king. But somehow we muddled through together, bucking his council of advisers and forging our own path until he went off to school."
I almost felt like his queen. Lady Gremlane seemed off in another land now.
"I remained his steward until after you were born. See, that's me right there."
She was looking at the painting of Arthur and Guinevere with baby Tedros. Tedros stared closer at the young female in the corner, with wild black hair, nut-brown skin, and deep red lips.
But... "You were beautiful,"
Tedros blurted.
Lady Gremlane burst into laughter. "Don't act so surprised."
It was the first time he'd ever heard her laugh.
"I loved being with your father," she said, smiling at the painting. "I only wish I'd been here to help him raise his child. Perhaps you would have trusted me more if you'd known me the way he did."
Tedros peered at her.
"So why did he let my mother fire you?"
Lady Gremlane's smile vanished, her eyes still on the painting.
"When it comes to women, men can be quite weak."
She turned to him, a chill settling in.
"In any case, when she returns, you'll no longer have use for me. Your mother will make sure of that."
"Well, I'm the king, not her,"
said Tedros. And though I hate to admit it, I need your help like you helped Dad when he first started, especially with Agatha gone now. My mother will respect my wishes.
Your father promised the same thing once, Lady Gremlane returned. But when the time came to stand up to his wife, he stayed silent. I left the castle without him even noticing.
I'm not like my father, Tedros said, for worse and for better.
And yet you break the same promises and tell the same white lies, said Lady Gremlane.
The words hit Tedros hard. He looked down at the Camelot shield on the floor. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw his steward's shoes inch closer. He could smell her powdered rose perfume.
You know why I've been so harsh with you and Agatha?
Lady Gremlane said quietly. Tedros lifted his head.
You reminded me of Arthur and Guinevere when he brought her here from school, she confessed. We were all so naive then, blinded by youth. We had no idea of what was to come. And then all these years later, to be steward to his son and his new princess. Perhaps I let old feelings get the best of me.
Tedros felt a twinge of guilt. This wasn't the frigid dragon lady that he and Agatha had made her out to be. She was a real human, with real emotions.
I'll stand up for you, no matter what my mother says, Tedros vowed. You have my word.
His steward searched his face. Slowly her pose softened, as if she saw she could trust him even if he didn't trust her.
I'm sorry, said Tedros.
It was a long time ago, Lady Gremlane sighed.
No, I mean for being so rude when you came to find me. You were trying to take me to our treasury meeting. You were doing your job.
Lady Gremlane's face clouded.
What is it? Tedros asked.
That wasn't the only reason I was trying to find you, she said.
From her pocket, she pulled a folded piece of newsprint. When he took it, her skin was clammy. Tedros opened it. It was a clipping from the Camelot Courier. Deceased, Chadwick of Foxwood. Loving son and brother and fourth-year student in the school for good. While on a quest to serve King Tedros of Camelot, Chadwick was killed on Avalon Island, as reported by an unnamed mongoose. He was 16 years of age and is survived by his mother, father, and two brothers, aged 12 and 17.
Professor Dovey contacted me this morning through her crystal ball, said Lady Gremlane hastily. She's despondent that the courier printed it without contacting her first. She wanted to tell you in person, but I said I would handle it.
Tedros buckled.
But how?
I pressed her, but she wouldn't give details.
Wouldn't give details? My best friend's dead, and Agatha's gone, and so is everyone else, and the dumb bat won't give details?
Tedros cried, grabbing and kicking at the wall. Frames fell around him, cracking against the floor.
He didn't send me a note. He shouldn't have even been in Avalon. I don't understand.
Lady Gremlane touched him. Tedros fell into her, panting softly. He stayed in her arms a long time.
He was my friend,
Tedros rasped.
And he always will be, Lady Gremlane said. You can't be here,
a voice cried in the hall.
Well, I am here, so clearly I can be,
said a hoary male voice.
But there's a warrant for your...
The doors to the hall flung open, and Merlin, Professor Dovey, and Lancelot all marched in, chased by a phalanx of stewards, both Tedros's and Agatha's, Reaper biting at their heels. Guinevere swept in last, regal and coiffed in a rich purple gown. She froze. The once queen gazed at her son covered in blood and in Lady Gremlane's arms.
"Lady Guinevere," said Lady Gremlane, letting go of Tedros. "They'll arrest you. How do you even get..."
"We'll take it from here, Lady Gremlane," said Guinevere.
Lady Gremlane straightened.
"The king and I have a meeting. You best leave the castle at what..."
"We'll take it from here," Guinevere thundered. The hall was dead silent. Lady Gremlane turned to Tedros, waiting for him to say something, to stand up in her defense. But Tedros wasn't looking at her any more.
"Mother,"
he gasped. He rushed into Guinevere's arms, wiping his eyes, before he moved on to embrace Professor Dovey, Merlin, and Lancelot. So thankful to have a family again, just when he needed one most. By the time Tedros even remembered his steward, Lady Gremlane was already gone. Chapter 14. Tedros. What it feels like for a king. The treasury master was put off until after lunch. Chef Silkomer nearly passed out when she saw there were five to feed, instead of just the king, and scampered back to the kitchens, which erupted in shrieks and a clatter of pans.
"I'd offer my hat to help, but it's on strike until I give it a pension plan,"
Merlin sighed, taking a seat in the Blue Tower dining room.
"Says it wants security."
"And I thought fairies were a challenge,"
Professor Dovey murmured, sitting beside him.
"It's Lance's fault," said Guinevere across the table. "Couldn't leave the hat alone, demanding food night and day, turkey legs and beef bourguignon, and enough bacon to rid the world of pigs. Wore the poor thing out."
Lancelot shrugged.
"A man needs to eat."
Sitting quietly at the head of the table, Tedros listened to the group banter. First about how they'd snuck into the castle, they'd mogrified into dung beetles beneath Merlin's hat and shoved it around like a dung ball, and then how they'd taken turns changing under Agatha's bed into clothes they'd hidden in the hat as royal guards made their rounds.
"But won't Lady Gremlane tell everyone you're here?"
Tedros cut in, wringing his hands.
"Won't they kill you for the bounty?"
The group went quiet. Merlin met Tedros's eyes.
"I'm afraid the time has come to endure such risks, Tedros. Given recent events, we need your mother and Lance to be at your side from here on out. That said, if anyone gets too close, I've reminded your mother and Lance how to use their spells from school to defend themselves."
Under Merlin's stern glare, Guinevere and Lancelot quickly lit their fingers. Guinevere's flickered feebly. Lance's burnt hot red, then snuffed out, spectacularly, with a loud fart sound and a burp of smoke.
"Or at least confound their attackers,"
Merlin piffed. Tedros managed a smile.
"You don't know how much I've missed you. All of you."
His mother smiled back, her eyes glistening.
If only this were a social call, said Merlin.
Tedros tensed. He knew there had to be a reason that Merlin would risk his mother's and Lance's safety, and Professor Dovey would leave her students to come here. But hearing it out loud made his stomach hollow.
I've had my fill of bad news today, he said. No news, good or bad, should be discussed on an empty stomach, Merlin assured. Silkamar!
More pots clanged in the kitchen. Lunch was meatballs with yellow curry, spaghetti squash with smoked paprika, and peppered radish patties, all of which had been violently spiced as if the cooks had taken out their angst on the food. By the end, Tedros had sweated through his shirt and the whole table spent as much time sniffling and gulping iced water as they did eating.
Dessert is chili-spiced truffles, Chef Silkamer announced, stone-faced. Perhaps we'll skip it, the wizard told the chef, waiting until she was gone before he turned to the rest. Shall we talk?
A short while later, they were all on one side of the table, some sitting, some standing, as they studied the quest map floating over them and listened to Professor Dovey finish recounting what she and Merlin knew about Chaddock's death and Sophie's and Agatha's adventures in Avalon.
After I spoke to them in my crystal ball, Agatha and Sophie started tracking the snake, she said, pointing at a miniature white-sailed ship inching across the savage sea. The Storian painted them last night aboard the Igraine, which should reach Jean Joly later today, judging from its movements here. But 4 quest teams are missing that I haven't been able to reach via Crow or Crystal Ball. Ruvens, Kiko's, Vex's, and now Beatrix's in Jean Joly. All their teams appear safe, given their names haven't been crossed out on my map. But each of the 4 teams seem to be moving away from their assigned kingdoms, which seems a rather ominous coincidence.
Tedros could see his mother and Lance as shocked by all this as he was.
This snake killed Chaddock and is going after our quest teams because of me, he said to the wizard and Dean. So, the lion and the snake, that story we learned growing up, it's real?
As a point of fact, no, said Merlin. The lion and the snake isn't a real tale at all, and whoever this snake is likely knows that.
What do you mean it isn't real?
Lancelot asked.
The Storian didn't write it, said the wizard. By all accounts, the lion and the snake was invented by an early king of Camelot 1,000 years ago. He and his brother both laid claim to the throne, so he made up this tale and spread it through the kingdom as if it were real. He portrayed his brother as the snake and himself as the lion, suggesting the kingdom would be in grave danger if his brother were picked to rule instead of him. The people listened and crowned him king.
So we grew up learning a fake fairy tale, Tedros said.
But is it fake if people believe in it? Asked Merlin. You assume that it is truth that makes a story valuable, because the tales that come from the Storian are true. The Storian writes history. But man is capable of writing stories too, and man has no obligation to truth or to history. Indeed, the Storian wrote its own honest version of the lion and the snake at the time, recounting the tale of the king who spread falsehoods to win his crown.
But it is a story no one remembers or tells. Instead, the story that lasted is the fraudulent one. Even the Royal Rot stopped reminding its readers long ago that the founding tale of Camelot is fabricated because no one seems to care. Something about the false story resonates with people. Something that makes the story endure, even if it's based in a lie.
And this snake, said Tedros, he believes the story is true?
You're not listening, Tedros. The story is 1,000 years old. Clearly the snake has no ties to the brothers in the tale,
Merlin said, voice hardening.
What matters is how the snake chooses to interpret the story. What matters is whether the snake believes he can use the tale to take your throne.
But the snake dies in the story, said Tedros.
Wrongly, in this snake's view, said the wizard. In the story, the snake believes the lion has stolen a throne that is his. The snake out there in the woods must believe the same thing about you. It's why he's chosen to live out this story again and see it through to its just end. In his mind, you've taken his throne. Now he wants it back. And it is up to you, as the true king, to stop him.
Tedros's head was pounding. I don't understand. No one else has a claim to the throne.
And yet your father's sword remains trapped in a stone. So your claim, too, remains in doubt,
the wizard hectored.
And if the snake comes for you, you've done nothing to show anyone that you are indeed the lion in this story.
What are you saying, Merlin? Guinevere asked, sharing her son's confusion. Merlin glared back at her.
His friend is dead, Guinevere. The rest of his friends might be next, along with his queen. Kingdoms everywhere are under threat and begging Camelot for help, only to get no response from its king. A king who someone out there believes shouldn't be king at all. So instead of jerking Excalibur day after day, which clearly isn't going to work, I'm saying he should be trying to find out why it stuck there in the first place. I am King Arthur's son, Tedros declared, leveling Merlin with a stare. I am the lion by birthright, and if a snake dares challenge that, I will kill him. With or without my sword.
The room was quiet. Merlin exhaled.
Clarissa, show him.
Professor Dovey didn't move. Grimacing, Merlin, I don't think we... The wizard turned to her.
Show him, or I will.
Professor Dovey took a deep breath and pulled a folded piece of paper from her pocket. She placed it on the table. This was the Storian's last page before I left for Camelot. I had one of the fairies copy it as best they could. Tedros pulled it open. You betrayed Chadwick for a snake? Sophie cried. Chadwick had Tedros's trust. Chadwick had Tedros's faith. What does a snake have? Slowly, the Lady of the Lake raised her eyes. He has Arthur's blood, she said. Tedros, his mother, and Lancelot all turned to Merlin, white as milk. Arthur's blood? Guinevere breathed. Lancelot shook his head.
That's
impossible, finished Tedros.
Not necessarily,
said Merlin, glancing at Professor Dovey as if they'd already thought this through.
There are a number of explanations for what the Lady of the Lake said to Sophie. The snake may be a relative of Arthur, a half-brother or nephew or blood cousin we are unaware of. The snake could be referring to having Arthur's physical blood in his possession, even to suggest that he killed Arthur, meaning he inflicted the mortal wound at the Battle of the Fourpoint almost 7 years ago. He could even mean it figuratively, that he has Arthur's blood on his hands and holds Arthur responsible for a crime he's committed. Whatever the snake's meaning, it made the Lady of the Lake let him into her kingdom and protect him over Tedros's knight. Even more, this snake must be quite the charmer, because it appears from the Storian's painting that the Lady of the Lake has lost her powers. Which means the lady likely kissed him as well.
The Lady of the Lake, sorceress eternal, kiss a boy,
Lancelot said, agape.
My reaction precisely, said Professor Dovey.
To seduce the Lady of the Lake into giving up her powers is a staggering feat, one that should strike fear into all of us,
said Merlin gravely.
But that isn't the only thing that's troubling. The Lady of the Lake is capable of mistakes. She has human emotions, after all. Excalibur, on the other hand, does not make mistakes. And it remains trapped in the stone at the same time that a snake has made its way into the woods, claiming to have King Arthur's blood.
Everyone was quiet, a thick unease filling the room. For the first time, Tedros finally understood what Merlin had been trying to tell him.
So there's two possibilities, Tedros said. One is the snake has no claim to the throne, and Excalibur wants me to prove I'm the true king, not him. Only then I can pull the sword.
Correct, said Merlin.
And the second possibility?
Asked Guinevere.
The second possibility isn't a possibility, said Tedros. The second possibility is that Excalibur is waiting for the snake to pull the sword and prove he's king, not Tedros, said Merlin.
Tedros felt nauseous, hearing the wizard say it out loud.
The snake can't have Dad's actual blood, he said, breathless. Dad had no brothers or sisters.
Unless there was one he didn't know about, said Guinevere. He called Sir Ector his father, the man who adopted him. I never met his real parents. I don't even know who they were.
Did Dad know who they were?
Tedros asked his mother. Guinevere blushed and stared at her hands.
I feel so stupid. I should have asked more about his family, but Arthur had a way of closing off certain avenues of conversation. There were many things we just didn't talk about. It's why it was so easy for the two of us to keep secrets from each other.
An uncomfortable silence fell.
After Lance and I left,
Guinevere started.
Is it possible, Arthur?
No, said Tedros. Dad never touched another woman after you abandoned him. He was faithful to you, even if you weren't to him.
Guinevere nodded, unable to look at him. Tedros's head was hammering.
Chadwick dead. Lady of the Lake kissed. Dad's blood.
What do we do, Merlin?
He asked shakily. The wizard looked him straight in the eyes.
My king, I am asking you that question.
Tedros saw the whole table turn to him.
When you were in peril at school, Clarissa and I did our best to intervene, said Merlin. We knew what we were up against with the schoolmaster, but this time Clarissa and I are of little help. This is no ordinary villain. Not if he made the Lady of the Lake betray you and drained her powers. The snake could surely waltz into Camelot and try his hand at Excalibur any moment he chooses, but he hasn't. Why? Because he wants to make you look weak first. He wants the people of the woods to see they're behind the wrong king. Only then will he come for Excalibur, when they no longer have a lion to believe in. And as that lion, you must stop him. So now, my dear king, you must tell us what to do.
Tedros swallowed, every muscle in his body rigid. He'd been king for more than 6 months, but this was the first time he'd felt like one.
I'll lead an army against him, he said finally. An army of good and evil, like my father would. The snake won't stand a chance.
Thank you, my king. Then that is what we will do, said Merlin, turning to the others. But we must build this army quickly.
Merlin, we have no soldiers, no knights, and no funds, said Tedros, feeling powerless again. We don't even know the snake's plan.
I said Clarissa and I would be of little help, not no help, said the wizard. Look closer at this map.
Tedros leaned in, as did his mother and Lancelot.
Or rather, look bigger,
the wizard said. He swished his hand and the floating quest map extended at both ends, showing more and more three-dimensional kingdoms far beyond the scope of the students' quests. Kingdoms Tedros had never heard of. Dannemora, Sing Sing, Hisa Hassan, Shangri-La. The map kept stretching across the length of the dining room until it jammed against the walls and started curling in, reaching around Tedros like a python.
The woods are endless. That we know, since fools like me keep trying to find the end of them, said the wizard, stopping the map's advance before it mummified the young king. And yet, the deans of the school for good and evil only assign students quests in the kingdoms nearest to the school. A perfect little orbit.
He swept his hand, lighting up the fourth years in a fluorescent circle around the twin castles.
Why? To keep students at close distance, should there be a need to dispatch a rescue team?
He erased the glow, along with all the figurines and names.
Now, let's look at the terror attacks in the woods. Terror that is supposedly random and assaulting kingdoms without warning. But is it so random? Look at where the attacks have happened.
Merlin pointed a finger, and instantly dozens of kingdoms on the map were plagued by shadows of magical terror. A raging fire in Glass Mountain, looting werewolves in Bloodbrook, clouds of bees in Gillikin, yogurt mudslides in Altazara.
If the terror were random, then one would expect it to appear everywhere, even in kingdoms at the farthest ends of the woods. But as you can see,
he nodded towards the extended regions of the map, blissfully clear of attacks.
They seem to have been miraculously spared. Instead, All the terror is concentrated right here at the center of the map. And, if we're even more precise...
He waved his hand, lighting up the afflicted kingdoms with fluorescent glow.
They're all in a perfect orbit, right around Camelot. Just as your classmates' quests are all circled around the school for good and evil.
Tedros stared at the illuminated sphere circling his kingdom.
Okay. I know I'm supposed to know what this means, but I wasn't as good a student as Agatha.
It means the unrest in the woods is as carefully planned as the quest assignments are. Professor Dovey cut in, sounding as teacherly as when she'd taught his good deeds class. The snake doesn't want the entire woods in upheaval. He only wants the kingdoms closest to Camelot to suffer, and he's paying his minions to target these kingdoms specifically.
But why the kingdoms around Camelot instead of Camelot?
Lancelot asked.
And why these small-time attacks? Fires? Looting? Bees? Why not just come for Tedros?
Oh, he's coming for Tedros, and soon. That is a certainty,
said Merlin.
Let him come for me, Tedros retorted, fists clenched. I'll kill him.
And that is precisely the snake's plan. To bait you into a fight you are not ready for,
said Merlin sternly.
You have no army yet. The people of Camelot doubt your place and fitness as king. The kingdoms around Camelot are plagued by chaos and fear, their rulers desperately calling on Camelot to save them as it has always done before. Only this time, Camelot's king has done nothing to help them. And yet, you still think you're ready to fight?
I'm King Arthur's son, Tedros defended.
A king is only as strong as his kingdom. A king is only as strong as his allies. A king is only as strong as his army. You are not strong, Tedros, and the snake knows it.
Said Merlin, bearing down.
You are as weak now as your father was in the last year of his reign, and his weakness led not only to his death, but to the fall of the kingdom into enemy hands.
Tedros went quiet.
The snake is well aware of your father's history, said the wizard. He will not give you the time to build an army or get stronger. Soon he'll reveal himself to the woods as the mastermind behind all these attacks and dare you to battle him on a grand stage. And it's quite clear what this stage will be.
Tedros paled.
The Four Point,
he said, meeting the wizard's eyes.
Where Dad was wounded.
It's surely why he tricked the Lady of the Lake into kissing him, so the Four Point would no longer be protected,
said the wizard. He pointed towards a tiny territory on the map not far from Camelot, where two Ever Kingdoms and two Never Kingdoms met. Jaunt Joly, Kingdom Kyrgios, Ravenbow, and Bloodbrook.
The Four Point isn't just a symbol of King Arthur's reign. It is the only reason there is lasting peace between good and evil, a truce point that reminds kingdoms Camelot will fight to protect the balance. The people of the woods are terrified right now. If the snake murders you on the same spot your father suffered a fatal blow, it means he is not just more powerful than King Arthur, but more powerful than his legacy. With that kind of power, I assure you no one will stop him from walking into Camelot and taking your crown, regardless of what becomes of Excalibur.
Which is why I should ride out there right now,
Tedros returned, rising from his seat.
No, it's why you shouldn't ride out there at all, said Merlin. Did you hear anything I just said? The four